I guess they didn't do anything until they at least got 500 subscribers at that time. And I think that this association certainly could be a very important keystone in developing this kind of movement in the United States, but also extending it to everyone who is interested in recordings and recorded projects. That doesn't mean that everybody would subscribe. There would be an equal number of subscriptions for every project, but we operate the same way that PolyGram operates. We have to go to all our companies all over the world, and you'd be surprised at the lack of enthusiasm at these meetings for these historical projects. I mean, you can hear it's like somebody dropped a lead bomb in the room, you know. I mean, it's really awful. And the only way that we can justify these things is having enough subscriptions in advance. I think the Metropolitan Opera Guild is very successful in that way, and I think that's absolutely the way to go. But I think that this association can play a very key part in really organizing this whole movement and getting it together. We'd love to do these things. It's just that commercially, a lot of them are not feasible.
I'd like to add to that that even the traditional outlets, if you will, for collectors' reissues, the Metropolitan Opera, Reader's Digest, whatever, have increasing problems of costs, that it becomes so expensive for them to mail a subscriber leaflet to their mailing list that if they don't get a, you know, 3,000, 4,000 return on something, they may not be able to do another thing like this. We work very closely with the RCA Record Club, which absorbed PolyGram's direct marketing efforts several years ago. And I had a really depressing talk with Dan Guss the other day about this. I mean, we're talking about relatively commercial projects of involving artists whose material has not been available just recently. Sorry.
Our friends over at the National Sound Archive, the British Library, a few years back went in and did some photographic surveys of the EMI archives, and they turned up enormous amounts of material that not only is not commercially feasible to issue, but probably is going to be increasingly uncommercial to hold. And yet this comprised a great deal of historically valuable material, ethnic material from all over the British Empire, materials issued. And I'd like to address, I'm certain other companies have material that's been generated, that, as I say, may not have commercial value, but has historical value. And what are your intentions on the disposition of that material, short of dumping it when you sell your company to another company or have to retool a plant?
That's a very big question, actually.
Terrible.
Puts out a lot of things. We have at EMI an absolutely huge library of pressings of all kinds, ethnic, going back to the very beginning of recording Fred Geisberg's tours to Russia and China and India in the 1900s, right up to the present day, masses and masses of Egyptian Arabic stuff. Fortunately, I'm not involved in transferring that. one of my colleagues a few years back spent 3 months transferring Arabic songs, and he nearly went crazy. It is difficult when a company gets into financial problems and has to amalgamate with another, as we in EMI know only too well. And when we amalgamated with Thorn Industry about 5 years ago, it was a terrible 6 months or so when it was deemed quite likely that the whole of our archives would be dumped. Records and masters. Fortunately, this did not occur, and it is not our intention to get rid of any of our archival material, but it has to be made possible to pay its way. which is one of the reasons that my reissues cost a great deal more than my division would like, because we have to pay the archives to pull the masters out of the shelves, and then we have to pay the factory to grow me some vinyl pressings, and so it gets very expensive. But this way, at least we are keeping the archives, and the accountants who run all our lives don't go around saying, let's get rid of it every 5 minutes. There's another associated topic I'd like to address, taking off my EMI hat and putting on a Historic Masters Limited hat. Not all of you may be aware that we are Historic Masters Limited, which is a non-profit making company chaired by Lord Harwood, of which I'm a committee member, is embarked on a reissue of 78 originals pressed on vinyls using EMI material at the moment. There's no reason at all why we shouldn't apply ourselves to other companies to ask them to make their material available to us at, of course, a reasonable commercial return. We issue 5 records every 6 months, and they're sold as a complete set. The cost is approximately £6 a record, which includes postage, I think. And if any of you are interested in this, I'd be very glad to put you in touch with where you can obtain more information about it. Because if people don't support this Historic Masters idea, of course it will fold, which would be a pity.
Have we got the address now?
No. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Can you give us some idea of what sort of music they're putting out on Historic Masters?
At the moment, it's exclusively
vocal
records, acoustic and electric. But again, if there's sufficient interest, there's no reason at all why one shouldn't have instrumental.
Classical vocal?
Yes.
Can I follow up on that previous question? Over the years, there have been rumors that the record companies have amassed a large number of recordings of live performances. For example, Covent Garden performances of the late 30s, specifically a Ringside. And I'm certain that RCA has a large collection of Metropolitan Opera recordings that the Met has not released, and when they do release them, they charge $100 or $125 a recording for each. What has happened about that, especially EMI? EMI has caused me to salivate. Every once in a while, we get a snippet of a live recording. For example, I believe in that Shai Yapin recording that we were talking about, I believe there's a snippet of a live recording. Then later on, we get another snippet. I understand that Lord Harwood has a large collection of these recordings. Is there any chance that they will be issued commercially? I realize there are legal problems involved, but don't you think they could, some of them could be released commercially, especially the Covent Garden one, with, I believe, Melchior and Leiter singing, or possibly Clark Schett, the third?
Yes. Firstly, can I draw your attention to an album now, alas, deleted, called Covent Garden Live, which I compiled about 6 years ago, which contains, I think it's 4 LPs, I think, all from live performances. Now, with regard to the performances made in the 30s, we haven't so far been able to issue any of them other than what hasn't already appeared, because of difficulties over payments to the Musicians Union, who demand payment of current rates. When you're issuing a record that's only going to sell 1,000 or 2,000, we just cannot afford to pay the orchestras as if they were recording right now. But the other major problem, I fear, is the non-availability of the material. Not only the material, but also the information. The 30s are a very unhappy period for EMI's documentation. We've got virtually all the paperwork from before the First World War and up until 1930. And then there's a horrible hiccup between 1930 and 1937, where our records are woefully incomplete. So that although I know there are rumors of complete green, I myself know only of a complete Rheingold, 27, I think it is, sides from Goethe-Demmerung, about 15 sides from Valkyra, and nothing at all from Siegfried. There's also eight sides of Schlagstad in Vliegende Hollander, and of course the famous excerpts from the Eva Turner, Martinelli, Turandot. Now these, we haven't got the shells of any of this material, I'm sorry to say, but we do have some pressings. We've got the complete pressings of the Tristan und Isolde, with Beecham conducting, which has already been pirated, but which we intend to bring out as soon as we can in decent non-pirated sound. As I told you earlier, the Bruno Walter Mozart Requiem is coming out next month. So that's, you know, that's a live that you're on about. And if anyone knows copies of these fabled ring performances, and also there's an Aida, I think, please let me know and I'll borrow them.
I'll use this as a chance to segue to a topic that I want to get into, but the segue is from Chelyabin and Covent Garden, because I have some information about recording. But in the last year, there has been disclosure of the existence of masters that both Victor in the United States and EMI, or at that point, Gramophone Company in England, were recording simultaneous two masters using two different microphones with the result of stereo recordings. And last May, there was a broadcast about it on NPR, and some unnamed RCA source was quoted as saying that there was no commercial interest in this. Well, in the past year, there has been very little of discussion of things that would be of more interest to collectors than these recordings. One note that I have here from Bill Morin is that in July 4th, 1928, Covent Garden Chelyabin concert is one of these that was recorded in stereo. We discovered that about 7 years ago. The only way we will be able to get these things, except for the occasional sides that both the 1 and 1A, or in the case of the Ellington issues, the SHQ and the RC versions of those records both were accidentally either released or came out with a test pressing that got into private hands. The only way we'll be able to get these things, except for these occasional snippets, would be for you people to go and check in both this country and in England your vaults and see what safety parts might be there and do some checking on these. Is there going to be some work that will investigate on these matters?
Of course, first.
Speaking for EMI in Europe, I can tell you that there is no truth whatever in this Californian idea that one and one were made from different microphones. And I have the authority for saying this from this. Let me ask me not to mention his name. From the engineer who was making these records right from the early 20s until he retired in the 60s and was in fact the engineer for the very first recordings ever made at Abbey Road. Two machines were used, when they were used, it wasn't always, purely to save time and artists' exhaustion. Indeed, there's a letter from Geisberg to Elgar, for example, saying, we have arranged to have two machines for you in order that you should not get too tired. Both these machines, when making commercial records, were fed from precisely the same microphone mix. And if people see two microphones in a photograph, they should not assume that they are both independent and producing a different signal for a different recording machine. In fact, we nearly always used four microphones for all big sessions, including Covent Garden. The inputs from these microphones were mixed and fed to one or two, or even sometimes three machines. If there are differences to be perceived occasionally between one and 1A, I can only account for it in differences in the characteristics of the cutting head, and even the scissors and waxes or
lots. In the case of the Duke Ellington that was issued, one was recorded with a LBRC prefix, and the other was recorded with an LBSHQ prefix. By definition, completely different equipment had to be used in order to have those two different prefixes.
Well,
microphone to cutter
I spent for EMI.
Yeah, but the chain is completely separate because the RC, SHQ, and HQ prefixes mean particular pieces of equipment for royalty payments.
I've had this on my desk since the article was published November of 85, and I've not done any follow-up on it. I want to back up a little here so we can get an overview of how do we accomplish these steps that have been proposed to the various record companies, and I speak for RCA Records. About 1.5% of our employee roster, which involves about 3,000 employees, works with recordings. That does not include the engineers. I'm speaking of artists and repertoire staff. And over the years, the A&R department of RCA has diminished. It's a very small staff. There's a small commercial operation, and there's a small Red Seal operation, and there's a small special products A&R staff. And it's a rather small group supporting this huge framework. This was discussed last week at RCA Records, and some of the producers said they were not interested in it. I did tell my producing staff that if they wanted to, because we have an obligation to our clients, because we produce on contract to give them the best quality possible, that I gave them the authority to pull out the 1 and the 1As and begin to work with them in the studio. So if there's a 1 and a 1A on Glenn Miller Moonlight Serenade, let's see what it's going to sound like. We're predominantly dealing in popular repertoire. And so that's my thinking. I'm willing to invest some time and some money to find out what does it sound like. We're releasing a lot of repertoire in the teens and 20s these days. I think maybe that the Ellington recordings, without having researched it, may have been experimental projects. May have been. I don't know. I have to research it. But the one and the one, yeah, but when you get to the standard 1 and 1A, I just think that's just going to give the illusion of a different kind of a sound because of a phasing change between the 1 and the 1A. So we'll do our homework and see.
Yeah, they went out of business in 1925, Phonotypia, yeah.
Are those Phonotypia shells, stampers, or whatever, metal parts still in existence?
I doubt whether CBS has them. In the 60s, AFR Lawrence came in and went through our plant at that time. It was in Pittman. And we have all our metal shells put away in boxes, and, you know, they're... what's there is there, but I doubt whether there's anything there from the Phonotypia. And even if there was, we wouldn't have the rights right now. I guess in Europe, because of the 50-year expiration, they can come out, and a lot of that material has appeared on Prizer, the rug merchant. He's got a terrific, he has access to, we do not even metal parts, but wonderful commercial pressings, and he's brought out quite a few of the Phonotypia masters, and a lot of other small companies like Pearl in England have brought out tons of Phonotypias.
Back in the 30s, there were two outfits. One was the IRCC of Connecticut, run by Mr.
Selson. Right.
And the other was the boy of Chicago, William Speckett.
And then there was Jack Caden here.
Historical Record Society. And they issued from actual master stampers, because you can see the incising.
And Columbia made those pressings for them on some of the material.
Victor, but they
right.
did issue Phonotypias
right.
by Victor Morell and different other
people. Absolutely.
Coletti and so forth, which were made from the original stampers because the XPH number is on there.
Right. So at that time, those stampers did exist.
They existed
at that. Yeah. And you probably, yes, I wouldn't be surprised.
EMI, I
released them.
because Tony Tapia was joined up with Odeon around about the time of the First World War, and then in its turn bought out by English Columbia. And now when Columbia amalgamated with HMV, EMI has the rights to Tony Tapia. We do have some shells, but alas, only very few. What happened to the vast bulk of them, I do not know. But I have to tell you something that might interest some of you. The original Tony Tapia ledgers have been lost for many, many, many years. I discovered them in our Milan factory last November, which was a great, great historical find.
Of course, the Oakwood Press came out with a reprinting of the Phonotypia catalog, at least.
Oakwood
so
Oakwood Press is pretty damn accurate.
Yeah.
But these ledgers not only tell us the exact details of all the unpublished material, but also the days on which they were made, the reasons
Wonderful.
Why things weren't issued, you know, cut evil, rejected by the artist, broken on arrival at the factory. That's something that's very interesting. Well, at the moment, I brought the further, I think, five volumes. I brought the first two back to England in my suitcase, but haven't got room for the others. We are still awaiting the arrival of them from our Milan factory. Again, if just a brief moment, it might interest you to know that I went to Milan with our chief archivist, Ruth Edge, to have a look to see how many 78 shells they had and if they were worth doing anything about. We thought they had about 10,000. It turned out they had about 50,000. And Ruth and I spent 4 or 5 dusty days looking at about 10% of them to see what they had. Most of what they had was absolute garbage. It's a matter of opinion, of course. wartime Italian pop by the mile, and a lot of post-war English pop, Anne Shelton, Ken McIntosh, and so on. But they don't seem to have destroyed anything at all since about 1937 or 8. So there's a great mass of interesting historical material. We are hoping that these shells will arrive in England within the next 2 or 3 months.
Great.
And after a great deal of sorting through, we'll be able to sort out the wheat from the chaff and perhaps make good use of it.
Coming back to Mr. Mumby, my original question, you explained about the Phonotypia now. How about the domestic Columbia with the Nordicas and Fremstats? Do you have the parts on those?
Some, not all. Our best bet usually is to get very good commercial pressings from the mid-30s because the early pressings were noticeable, were very noisy, pressed on very noisy material. And we have had collectors, unfortunately, who have ordered pressings, and some of them, unfortunately, have made off with some of the metal parts. I won't mention any names, but one of them lives in the Philadelphia area. Yes? What?
I think this is centrally implied by the topic of this discussion this morning, and I don't know if there's an easy answer, but I want to ask anyway. Does the compact disc so-called revolution and the new mastering process imply that further down the road that it will be easier to process specialized historical material in this format, or is it always going to be something that has to be mass-produced to be commercially effective? And to you, Mr. Hardwick, and perhaps to others, this historical master's program seems very interesting, but once again, will there be other material available on it besides classical music? Will some of the Gaisberg ethnic touring records possibly go in? Is it economical to do those in small enough editions to allow for more obscure material? Two questions.
I'll answer the latter one.
That's now.
I think it's highly unlikely that we will ever be issuing these ethnic or pop things which you are asking about. Not just because they were mean, but because we haven't kept the shells. You appreciate, I'm sure, that in the 85 years or so that commercial recording has been going, millions of records must have been made, tens of hundreds of thousands by EMI alone. And if we'd kept every shell that we
God, it would occupy the whole of England and it would sink. The trouble, this is basically that we have retained almost nothing from the non-classical 78 era. And, it was a decision, and perhaps the wrong one, but that's it.
I think regarding your first question, the next presentation, which is going to be very interesting, by Danny Haladic and Barton Wimble, may very well answer, may be the answer, because the transfer of monaural material via analog has always left something to be desired, and the transfer now directly onto digital master may be the way to go, and probably is going to reveal a lot of sound that is in those masters that nobody knew were there. Because if we can do what we have done already with recordings from the late 50s and 60s, I imagine that this is going to be quite a revelation and may cause quite a revolution.
I'm sure the reality will, Peter, be better, if I may, please. We have our digital masters today. They're all analog.
They're all analog, but you may have in the future. You're not presenting it today, but I think later this afternoon and tomorrow there's going to be some. There'll be some panels on that.
But will it allow materials to be made available in smaller editions?
Well, again, we have to come back to the. You know, I think we're going to have to go into some kind of a subscription, especially if it's a small. I think we covered that earlier. If the market is very small, if it's a specialized market, we're going to have to come up with some kind of a way of getting this out, and I think it's going to have to be supported by the people who are the most interested. What, Stephen?
I don't agree with that at all. I think there's a key point here, which the United States has a 75-year copyright. I just heard the mention of a 50-year continental, which is inaccurate. There are places on the continent where the copyright period is 30 or 35 years.
Right.
There's no reason why, if the companies don't let loose, that we cannot form a corporation over in Italy or in Vienna or someplace like that, produce records over there, distribute them worldwide from that, the same way Chrysler records are handled, and funnel everything through someplace where the copyright period is reasonable. When you let a record go out of print, as far as I'm concerned,
I would like to ask a question. I would like to ask a question.
Only if they keep out the trademark. No, I beg your pardon. Anything that is in violation of American copyright law is kept out.
But I would like to ask a question of this gentleman here. What you said, reasonable. What do you mean by reasonable?
Then that is the country in which to produce records for the period where it is in copyright elsewhere, but out of copyright there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to take bread out of your mouth. I'm trying to point out that there is this gap, and instead of trying to create a bigger bureaucracy, simply work through a situation that exists.
And do you feel that the copyright laws in this country are unreasonable?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I think 75 years is far too long.
And what part of the copyright are you speaking of?
The copyright on
the savings clause in section. I believe it's 302 of the phonograph section. The 372
report. Okay, then.
If as an entertainment lawyer I can speak to this, I will try to explain it as quickly as possible. Under the 1909 Act, only a writing could be protected. Under the Constitution, federal law preempts state laws. At the time that the new Copyright Act was put in, the record companies pointed out to Congress that any recording that they had made up until 1972, when the first Phonograph Act in the United States went in, would automatically be donated to the public, simply because federal law preempts state law and all of the state unfair competition rules that come from cases like Metropolitan Opera versus Wagner Nichols, 101 New York. I think it's page 150, but it's been 10 years since I've looked at it. Everything would go into public domain, whether it was Caruso records or Beatles.
everything.
People
would have
been
effective January 1, 1977, when the new act took effect. The waiver compromise was that we will allow the owners of rights in sound recordings to preserve their state law rights for a period of 75 years from the enactment of the first phonograph statute, from the effective date of it, which was in 1972, which means, in essence, the Caruso recording that went into the, that's a bad example. The Fort Wengler recording, that's also a bad example. let me think of a good one. The Edward Elgar recording that went into the public domain, allegedly in England, on December 31st, 1983, let's say, does not go into the public domain in the United States until January 1, 2048. Now, I agree, in principle, that is unfair to those of us who are eager to fill the gap that we perceive between what the record companies cannot do because they cannot make a financial go of it, and their rights to exploit for their benefit in order to fund the cost of new recordings to protect their property. People have a right to control their property, as Alice has put it. There is this dichotomy, but I want to remind you of one other thing. You talk about it's being unfair, and, you know, set up a company in England, what about all the Chrysler records that come in? What about all the Pearl records that come in? What about all the pirate records that are made in this country? Don't ever forget that those records are allowed to circulate in this country by the tacit sufferance, the tacit permission of the record companies who choose not to swat at the mosquitoes. They could put out of business every single pirate company if they wanted to enforce their contract rights, and if they wanted to enforce their copyright and trademark rights through the International Trade Commissions, they could keep every one of the Chrysler records and Pearl records from coming in by simply impounding them at the courts.
We don't do it because we don't want to give the lawyers so much money.
Mortimer, what? Mortimer, what?
If I may be very mundane and get away from these very, very heavy legal matters, I'd like to ask Peter a question about a fact that he stated. If I understood you, Peter, correctly, in your first presentation, you said that roughly in the period around 1939 to 46, Columbia was recording simultaneously on 16-inch discs and 78 RPM master. It was my understanding of that I've gotten from several sources, one of them was present at the recording session of the Mahler Symphony in Metropolis in Minneapolis, that Columbia gave up, pretty much, recording on 78 RPM masters, and knowing that the LP was really down the pike and that would become a reality, already had in the back of the mind, used only the 16-inch discs and made their 78 RPM releases dubs of those. Do you know anything about them?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I think that over and beyond that, that there were several machines running at the same time, so that the 78s were not necessarily dubs of the safeties. The safeties were backup machines, 33 and a third, you know, electrical transcriptions actually, but they were running simultaneously. I guess in some cases there were dubs when they did not have the other machines going, but I don't think that you can say that for every session, that they were running more as we got into the 40s, because the LP in 39 and 40 was not, was, you know, RCA had made LPs, actually ETs, in 1931, 32, but they were a failure because of the playback equipment and because of the material involved. But the LP really didn't get a big boost of development until after the war and until after our side captured the German tape machines, you know, and tape really made LP possible. So I'd say that starting with 45 and 46 with Bachman and a lot of the other people at RCA, including Goldmark and Schnepfangers actually was the man who developed the LP and never got the credit. He did a wonderful work at that time because he developed the grooving, the micro grooving process that made the whole thing possible. And of course, at that time, we did have probably starting around 45 and 44 and 43, we started really getting very heavily into the electrical transcriptions, the 33 and a third safeties. But you'll find that a lot of the 78s are not dubs at all. I think all you have to do is listen, and you'll see that the sound is instantaneous. It is direct. Mortimer, yes.
It's been a tantalizing decoder. When Columbia started to bring out the first batch of LPs, what did they use as the source material for those items that had obviously already appeared on 78? Did they go to the 16-inch disc?
A lot of the 16-inch discs were used. And I'll tell you who can give you a very definitive answer on this is Howard Scott, who's over working at Macmillan now, because he put together that initial release.
Thank you.
Okay.
Question for each member of the board in turn, working from something Mr. Pano said earlier. We're collectors here, but some of us are also scholars, and we do research. And primary sources for research are in the files and archives of record companies. Things such as documentary research, the making of discographies or histories in the recording industry, hearing recordings for study, sometimes obtaining tape copies with the company's permission from archives, and even possibly preparing reissues in small numbers for specialist collectors and users. So my question is, if each of you would say what your company's policy and attitude, which may be different from the policy, towards such approaches from the outside, and if your policy and attitude is positive, whether you would be willing to say here and for publication in the Ars Journal, who is the proper contact person to approach, not necessarily by name, but by office, and what would be the proper way to go about this for those who have research projects or other reasons to work with the archive in your company?
Well, it's hard for me to say. Alfred Kane, whom I know many of you know, is our local authority on the archives of Deutsche Grammophon. I don't know whether Alfred Kane, who has a full-time job, could manage to field the number of inquiries that publication of his name and address in the journal might cause. Apart from that, I think I'd really rather defer on giving an answer, and if I can find out somebody to call, I will talk to Alfred and ask how to deal with this.
As I say, it's not merely a matter of dumping on one particular person, but finding corporate policy and attitudes
right.
And how to go about working. Okay.
We are woefully understaffed. We only have one full-time archivist at CBS. And I have talked to this person. This person says that if you will send in your questions, and they will be answered, but you have to allow anywhere from a month to 2 months for your answer. And it's very difficult at this present time. We don't have a policy of letting people in from the outside, because these are just company archives. They're not open to the public. That is a problem, and I don't think it's going to be resolved until we get a greater staff at that time and have different kind of facilities than we have now. I don't see that in there.
No.
I doubt it. Not at the present time. It doesn't look bright.
How about microfilming, Peter? You decided to try and go that way, because I know they've done that at RCA.
Yeah, but it didn't work out that well though.
A bad picture is harder than nothing.
Yeah.
No, it's not. Bad picture is almost me. Take care.
Okay. There is no corporate policy at RCA Records for archivists and researchers. You would direct your inquiries, again, preferably by letter or telephone call if you're desperate, to the A&R Administration, RCA Records, 1133 6th Avenue, 9th floor, New York 10036. And within the A&R Administration group, there will be three people there that might be available to set you up for an appointment to come in and do your research or to check a question for you if you live in New Zealand. In special products, questions and inquiries can be addressed to Gerald Plano or to Chick Crumpacker. We get, on average, 8 to 10 inquiries a day. Somehow, we do get back to you with a note, yes, we have it, no, we don't. Bearing in mind that we have no corporate policy, this little group of unofficial archivists and historians within RCA Records welcome your projects, welcome what you're out to find. You know from the last 25 years that I've been there that we've brought you into the building, you've done your research, and you've most likely have found what you've wanted to find. I get back to a point I made earlier in the program this morning. It sure helps in your correspondence to tell us who you are and what you're doing and what you plan to do, and it gives us an overview and we can make some quick decisions to help you get your project successfully completed.
Shall I just finish that question from the EMI point of view? I too will have to adopt a slightly stonewalling attitude because we are better off than the CBS. We have two archivists, both very capable young ladies, but they have a hell of a lot to do, not just answering questions. Having said which, we do try to accommodate people who have reasonable questions, and I think our chairman knows that he doesn't, you wouldn't always meet with an icy reception. Given reasonable notice, people can come and look at our microfilm, and the archivists or I will answer any questions. But you have to be patient, because it all takes time.
Can I ask a question? Very unpopular about Toscanini. We have heard all the wonderful things that have been done to the Brunavolta recordings, thanks to Peter. We have heard all the wonderful things that have been done to Furtwängler. All see this going back to the best sound source. There was an article in the Atlantic Monthly of February 8 on the Toscanini sound by William Youngren speaking in great detail about the new Toscanini CDs. What is RCA doing about Toscanini and bringing the best sound from the originals, if they still can be found, onto CD?
I was not involved in that project. And therefore, since I was not involved in that project, I'm going to have to make an assumption. My assumption is that when the request came in for source tapes, that they were directed to an employee of the RCA Record Company in New York who didn't know how to read the matrix information and the dash numbering information and how to decipher or how to arrive at what was the original or the best source. Now, that's my comment on that, and I don't want that published. Had the request come into my A&R group, we would have gone to the best source possible. I was not involved in the project.
Before we go on too much further, I want to say that we have we have about 5 more minutes for questions, and then we want to play a Guess Who This Is tape. It doesn't matter. It's fine. Can I just take 3 more questions and then we'll...
Hey, look at the 19, 15, 16, 17...
He's already spoken. I have a question.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have. I have an answer.
I have a very important question to go.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just...
I have an
three more.
Gentleman about the Columbia work. He doesn't remember me, but I worked at Howard Scott.
Right.
I remember you.
Paul Gordon.
I remember
you,
Mr. Gordon.
Yeah. We did a lot of metal parts.
Right. I guess we could.
Maybe that might be something to discuss briefly afterwards.
What can we do for you? I mean, is there some way that we can help enable some project? Is that we are a great piece of knowledge and of record?
Yes, I love to see material reissued. As far as the RCA record vault is involved, I'd like to see everything out. I really would. And I get back to a point I made earlier. I'd like to see the association form a collector society, divided up into groups of interest, opera, classical music, jazz, Broadway performances, legendary performances, bluegrass, and so on, and begin to prepare your collections. And as far as RCA Records is concerned, if you come up with a charter and you come up with a logical program, we will open our vaults to you.
No, the Bruno vault, not they have in first place, that's an unfair question. They haven't all had such. That's a typical Leslie Gerber question. You son of a bitch. Just wait a minute. Those records were prepared by CBS Sony at that time. They don't all have, some of them are 55 minutes, some of them are 60. I must say that I am taking advantage of the 73 minutes plus playing time. We have a CD coming out with 74 minutes and 44 seconds, so you beat that one, you know. The Brahms violin concerto and the Brahms double with Stern. So we will be taking advantage of that. I mean, after all, that was a maiden voyage. I think they did a wonderful job, and there are CDs there with an hour and more of music on there. They're not all that short.
Yeah. I know my question will be and it's directed to all of the members of the group except Columbia, because I know what the situation is in Columbia. You know I'm doing a history of the industry, of the American industry. I know what I found at EMI in 1977, which was, I was told, I could use the archive. Has that changed in terms of researchers who have a specific informational need who have to look at large masses of material?
I'm surprised to hear you were rebuffed in 1977.
Because
I know, for example, there's been a guy in England who's just produced a catalogue of all the Columbia records, and he has been with the archives for week after week, month after month.
My need is not to that type of information. I am after letters, say, William Barry Owen to Emil Berlin. Berlin is in Poland, 1897, 98, 99,
99. Well, if it exists, I see no reason why you shouldn't have photo set copies. I say, if it exists.
It exists.
Why is the archives?
I have a question in reference to contemporary music. And I guess I'm addressing this mainly to Mr. Mundy's, but I'd also be curious as to how the other companies have handled this as well. When a major orchestral work has been recorded, and I'm thinking specifically of the Carter Concerto for Orchestra, which was recorded by CBS Masterworks in the late 1970, right after the premiere, and then brought out and then deleted and picked up by Composers Recordings Incorporated, quite a few of the recordings. Now, from what I understand, my information is rather old upon this, but I received a number of desperate letters from Elliot Carter last year and from other people saying that it is now being deleted because they could not keep up with the paperwork just to extend the license on this recording of the Concerto for Orchestra, that it wasn't worth their while. Unless, I think the figure which was cited was 5,000 copies were sold each year. Now, this has already been mastered, it's already been stamped, it's already been issued. It's just a question of keeping up the license. And since major orchestral works are very, very hard to prepare, the record has to almost live for that piece. Any student who wants to hear that piece, or any music lover indeed who wants to hear that piece, will have to be able to find a record because it's doubtful that it will be repeated even by the Philharmonic. So I guess my question is, can something be done about this? Because especially Columbia has a priceless heritage of all the modern American music series recordings of the 50s. And until recently, they've been fairly easygoing about allowing them to be licensed. That seems to be coming to an end. And if so, what will happen to all this material, and how will it be heard?
Well,
I'll look into it. This is the first I've heard about that, because our policy has been to lease material to CRI, who are superbly equipped to reach this market. We're not. And they sell libraries, and they sell the music schools, and they get to students, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I'll try and get you an answer on that.
One more.
Well, the limit is 75 at the most. That really is the uppermost limit. Most of them are limited about 73 minutes of top for musical information. That's it. So 70 minutes is very close to the limit.
Dolly Motto, a Swedish company, has published one track, which is 70 minutes of one performance, and the other track.
All right, that's in mono.
That didn't
that's
work.
In mono.
I'm told by PolyGram that did not work.
PolyGram could not press it.
Uh-huh. I want to hear it.
Well, Nimbus will press anything.
It seems to me that I understand we have just enough time. How many of our panelists are going to be able to stay afterwards, or do we have to get back to other things?
It's hard.
No, I
have to go back. Okay. Unfortunately, I have to go back to the office.
Yeah. At least one of our panelists will be here. You can bend his ear. And Keith, of course. I understand we do have a tape, and in order for this not to get too hot and heavy with section 101,
that's fair use.
That's right. We're going to play, in fact, a proprietary tape that Jerry has brought along that is kind of named that tune. So I don't know if that's racked up and ready to go, but
and some of the pitch time is not correct.
That's right. So. The first one, we'll simply proceed with this. It's kind of an overview of the kinds of things that RCA has found interesting. Pardon me, Victor has found interesting and attractive, and I suppose we can start right there.
What's the record number?
Boom.
Yeah. No, now that man has to pay twice for his dinner.
They missed that one?
Yep.
Oh, good.
Bremel.
Nelson Eddy.
Is this the closing one?
Yep, there's more.
Tell them more.
Yeah. Should we use the 1 and the 1A on this one?
That
this is not the 1 and the 1A.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. Yeah. Now listen to the pleasure.